Hi, everybody. This is Brandon Mancini with the Radonk on the Run podcast, and we're here for season one, episode two of our newly launched podcast. And I'm amazingly joined by Dr. Melissa Brackman, who's assistant professor of gynecologic oncology at Michigan Medicine.
Thanks so much for having me.
So obviously, most cancers have kind of a specific, unique awareness month, bringing attention, advocacy, awareness, research funding for that given month. January being Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Why do you believe that's something that's important? And what message do you hope patients and providers take away from it each year?
That's a great question. I think that it's important that patients understand, first and foremost, that cervical cancer is common, but not something that people talk a lot about. This is one of the things globally, I feel like, about gynecologic cancers is that some of the organs that we treat, the vulva, the vagina, cervix, are things that are not discussed. And so I think it's important to have Awareness Month so that people are thinking about it and hearing about it. And cervical cancer is also something that we have a lot of great screening tools for, and that if it's caught early, it's very treatable and curable. And then if it is later and more advanced, it becomes very challenging to treat. So I hope that patients can and families can hear the message that this is something that if we stay on top of and vigilant about, that we have the opportunity to really make a big impact.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think really cervical cancer, it's one of the few cancers when it's all said and done, that is something that can be screened and is recommended to undergo routine screening. And then uniquely also has a potential vaccine that can be delivered to kind of reduce someone's risk over time. And do you mind kind of describing the screening process, kind of what's historic and maybe how things are changing?
Yeah. So the screening you're referring to is called a pap smear. And sometimes people will misconstrue that they've had a pap smear versus having a pelvic exam. A pelvic exam to a GYN oncologist is that someone has put a speculum in the vagina and opened it and looked at the cervix and then has taken that out and done what we call bimanual exam, where we use a gloved hand to feel the pelvic organs. The pap smear is the actual brush that goes into the cervix and collects cells from the surface of the cervix and of the internal canal. And pap smears can show us precancers of the cervix as well as cancers, and those precancers can then get treated. Cervical cancer in general is something that takes a long time to develop. And so if we can catch high-risk precancers and then treat them, then we never have the cervical cancer at all. And the screening, that pap smear test has been something that was previously recommended to be yearly until more recently, when we have been doing it about every 3 to 5 years, depending on people's testing results, in particular because of the HPV virus and its association with cervical cancer. So it's a very large portion, probably 95%+ of cervical cancers that are associated with the HPV virus. And so patients who have a number of normal pap smears in a row and don't have presence of the virus, which is also tested for on that pap swab, then they can space out their screening.
No, that's great. In that HPV discussion, can you explain to us about the vaccine and how that came about and some of the different changes that have been occurring over time since its inception?
Yeah, this is a really exciting thing for us as GYN oncologists, because it's treatment is a big focus of what we do. Surgeries, radiation, chemotherapy, targeted therapies, but this is prevention. And that's really cool. It's stopping the cancer before it even starts. Because if people get the HPV vaccine, it helps build immunity in their body to fight against the HPV virus. So then if they get introduced to the virus, which it's a pretty ubiquitous virus that almost everybody is exposed to at some point in their life, that then their body will fight it and it won't become this sort of chronic infection within the cervix. And the vaccine started as it was against 2 different strains of the virus, then 4 and now 9, because it's strains that cause cervical cancer and other cancers of the vulva, the vagina, penis, anus, and then head and neck cancers also. So tonsils, tongue. So it's 9 different subtypes of the virus in it. And it really drastically reduces the risk of chronic HPV infection and developing the precancers and the cancers. It's a vaccine that's available starting at like age 9 to 11. And so it's recommended to be given kind of prior to people are ever even exposed to the virus. It's a two-dose vaccine if a patient is under the age of 15, and then a three-dose vaccine series above the age of 15 until obviously something you probably ask about a very recent change for Health and Human Services about the dosing series. And it, in countries with high uptake, like Australia, for instance, they have seen the numbers of cervical cancer just plummet over just a couple of decades of pretty routine use.
Wow. No, it's amazing. And I think kind of as you alluded to, really vaccination in general has been a hot topic in our country for a bit here. And I think with that recent recommendation from the Department of Health and Human Services to consider just a single dose of the HPV vaccine. Do you have any specific thoughts on that right now?
Yeah, this is a tough question because I feel like, as you pointed out, there's research and data, but there's also a lot of social and cultural and emotional baggage around vaccines right now. The trial that was based off of actually is a pretty robust trial, I have to admit. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in December. And basically, they were looking at unvaccinated folks, patients getting one dose of the vaccine and patients getting two doses, if they had HPV infections several years out. And if they had HPV infections, did they clear them or were they persistent? And noted that if given in that at that young age in the under 15 group, that if you give just one dose, it seems to be about the same rate of persistent infections as if you give two. As an oncologist, I can look at it and say, if this is a well-designed trial and it makes sense, and I'm glad that they've done it. But I really would like to wait to make changes to the vaccine series until we see cancer data. Because, you know, persistent infection is, I think, a proxy for, you know, eventual cancer risk. I think also the flip side of it is there has to be harm from getting two or three doses that we think is prevented by only getting one dose. Mm-hmm. And it's an extremely safe vaccine with an excellent safety profile. And other than like sight pain and redness, there are really no major side effects of it with long, long, long-term safety data. And so I think that the implication here is that if one dose is just as good, that we should do that because it's safer. And I don't think that we really have any reason to believe that two doses is unsafe.
Sure. No, that makes a ton of sense. So yeah, more to come. We'll be interested to follow kind of any follow-up on that study long-term, like you said. But kind of switching gears, kind of more to what you do each and every day from a therapeutic side or helping patients that do ultimately develop cervical cancer. Obviously, in your career, you see a lot of changes through training and fellowship and even into practice. But kind of over the last 5-10 years, what are some of the most exciting things that you feel have happened for the treatment of cervical cancer, both with surgical and systemic therapy perspective over that period of time?
Mm-hmm. So that's probably in the last 5-10 years, we'd be talking about targeted therapies. And I think of those for cervical cancer in kind of two main buckets. One of them is immunotherapy, which, you know, your listeners might be familiar with broadly, but I'll just give a quick overview is that an immunotherapy, one of the common ones is called Keytruda or pembrolizumab is its generic name. It's not universal that everyone will respond to Keytruda, but lots of patients will. And so not only does it help us get better control over advanced and metastatic cervical cancers, but it's really pretty well tolerated for most patients, and it can be continued as a maintenance medication. So we give it with the chemo up front, our traditional chemos, and then after a few cycles of the chemo, usually about six, we can switch to doing just the Keytruda alone, and patients can be coming in every 3 weeks for a long time, feeling well and living well on Keytruda. Another really exciting development in cancer in general, but also in gynecologic oncology specifically, is something called an antibody drug conjugate. The example for cervical cancer is called tisotumab. And these antibody drug conjugates are also trying to kind of take advantage of specifics on the cancer cells to help get chemo into them. Because one of the main mechanisms by which cancer cells become resistant to chemo is the chemo either can't get in or it's quickly kicked out of the cancer cell. And so both of these, the antibody drug conjugate tisotumab and then pembrolizumab, are helping people live longer and better with advanced and recurrent cervical cancer.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. To your point with other cancers, right? Everything is getting more targeted, identifying unique aspects where these targeted treatments in theory and in practice tend to have a little bit more better tolerability, maybe less universal side effects from kind of classic systemic therapies. So it's exciting to kind of make those monumental leaps, definitely. So no, that's excellent. And I think kind of even talking about side effects, that's a good segue. Just in your experience, when you're interacting with patients, that is something that comes up endlessly, and patients are worried about kind of how said surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, systemic therapy is going to impact them both in the short and long term. As far as just your surgical approaches to cancer, what do you typically go over? What are the most common things when you're addressing someone with cervical cancer?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it also kind of ties into the idea about advances. I tell a lot of patients, and frankly, our students, residents, and trainees, that cancer surgery, which is a big part of my practice, has sort of globally become less radical over time as we've become to better understand these diseases and how they spread and the best sort of ways to safely control them. So I talk to patients about some, you know, universal surgical risks, which are things like bleeding and infection and injury to other organs. And then some of the long-term, you know, specific risks to the types of hysterectomies that we do for cervical cancer. Sometimes it's things like bladder dysfunction or scar tissue formation. Within the last like 5 years, we have started to do more simple hysterectomies for cervical cancer instead of radical hysterectomies. And these are two big trials called SHAPE and CONSERVE that try to look at factors related to the cancers, their sizes, the exact kind they are, to say, does this person really need the bigger surgery? A radical hysterectomy includes the uterus and the cervix, but also a portion of the vagina and tissue on the side called the parametria. And so a lot of the additional risks in terms of bleeding and injury to other things comes with it needing to go from a simple to a radical hysterectomy. And so that's actually been a really great advance. And I can tell patients not only sort of these are the risks of the surgery that you're having, but this is how it's actually, you know, safer and less complicated than the ones that we used to do. A lot of the risks of surgery are actually temporary. And I think that's an important thing for people to recognize, is that recovery can be challenging, but with the ability to do the less radical surgeries, to do minimally invasive approaches with small incisions on the belly, patients can go home from the hospital sooner. They take less narcotics. They're up and walking and doing normal things quicker. And I find that most patients are well recovered from any surgery we need to do for them within about 6 to 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. No, that's awesome. I think same thing with other cancers, right? It's the ability to navigate and go less radical. It seems to be more or less ubiquitous, which is exciting, and absolutely better quality of life over time. And just as far as side effects go, I know we kind of discuss kind of the immediacy of surgical. As far as kind of approaching that patient holistically in that personalized medicine viewpoint, sometimes cervical cancer is associated with a slightly younger demographic as compared to things like endometrial cancer and so forth. What are some of the unique aspects of counseling before and after, or unique needs for that patient population that are specifically addressed when their cancer is treated?
Absolutely. It is unfortunately tends to be, as you said, a younger patient population. And so I'm thinking about several patients in my head right now who are parents, who are working, who are trying to, you know, do regular lives in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and manage their cervical cancer. So some of the things we think about are the logistics of just getting blood draws, having infusions in a port versus an IV, how far people are from the infusion center, if they have to get a treatment that can be all in one day versus, you know, a Monday and a Tuesday. We also, a newer, I would say, thing on the scene is a cold capping therapy, which is becoming more and more asked about, I would say, in our patient population. It is used to try to help prevent the hair loss that come with Taxol and other taxanes. And it also is, that's got a lot of pieces and setup and such. But that, I think, is a really important marker for a lot of my patients, especially my younger patients, that they are sick and that they are on treatment. We've had a ton of advances as well in things like nausea management. When patients come in and we talk about their chemos or their radiation and what the expected side effects are, almost everyone knows someone who's had a cancer. And sometimes it's the same kind and sometimes it's very, very different, but they come in with thoughts and feelings and worries about what the side effects are going to be. And so I like to spend a fair amount of time, you know, just asking questions and gathering what they're worried about, what's most important to them. Because for one patient, going through the efforts that cold cap therapy requires is 100% worth it. For another person, it's much more about the ability to time things around their work schedule or their the rest of their life. Nausea is a big one that people worry about. They think of chemo and they think of being, you know, sick all the time. But we do a pretty darn good job of controlling nausea now. And patients have meds that they get during infusions and for a few days afterwards, and then extra ones that they can take. We'll set people up for hydration, you know, a few days after if they need to have some extra fluid. And we have at Michigan Medicine, at least, and I assume most places are going to be the same way, we have a specific clinic dedicated to symptom management, and they consult on a lot of our patients who are struggling not only with cancer symptoms, but also with symptoms from our treatments.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think the comprehensiveness, I mean, in our careers for sure, but it becomes more and more prevalent, like with the access to information, a lot more involvement of patients and family members with their care than maybe it used to be several years ago. And so empowering them with a lot of good resources and people to help them with every thing associated with cancer and its therapies is super important. And just in general, right, because you're in a very unique specialty where you're managing systemic therapies, but you're a highly skilled surgeon simultaneously, and you take part in even the radiotherapeutic attributes of cervical cancer management too with the radiation oncologist. So you have lots of good perspective and you see the disease across a whole array of stages and situations, kind of in each of those situations with the ultra curative local therapies where people may need minimal treatment, to kind of the intermediate versus those where that cancer has spread distantly and it's more kind of managing over time. What is your personal approach to kind of balancing hope with realism for patients as you go through it? Because obviously that's delicate and even what you said, unique to each and every person, but definitely interested in how you approach that.
Yeah. And it's, like you said, it's a personalized approach by patient and disease. And it also, honestly, probably by physician. I think my personal approach, just speaking for myself, is that it's really important to me to know my patients well and to know things about them outside of their cancer. And I know most physicians take a social history and want to know about people. But my colleagues here will sometimes chuckle about the Brackman social history because it's, I can't just remember someone based on their stage and their sights. But when someone says, you know, the lady who drives a truck, and I was like, oh, yes, yes. Or the one who has, you know, four kids and then, and he's going to be a collegiate swimmer. That's the stuff that really sticks with me. And I think it also is what helps me then to make treatment plans that make sense for that patient and their family. And this is where the balancing of the realism and the hope comes in, because I always want to be upfront and truthful with people about what their cancer status is and what I know to be true and what I cannot know and cannot predict. But I want patients who have, you know, an unfortunately non-curable situation, which happens with cervical cancer sometimes, to know that what we're doing and why we're doing it is with the intent for them to live as long and as well as they can, but not for it to be gone and never come back. And to be able to just keep that communication open very truthfully, then comes in the piece of knowing them really well, because that can help with making each day and week and month as good as it can be. We make changes to treatment plans in terms of, say, we're worried someone's going to have neuropathy, numbness in the fingers and toes, and because they're a concert pianist. Well, then maybe we need to start with a different chemo, a sister drug, so that we can make sure that that very important piece of their life, it can continue on. So I think some of the hope honestly comes from living as well as you can with cancer, even if the goal is not to make the cancer completely gone. I also have the benefit of getting to be a GYN oncologist at such a really exciting time, because I can say very truthfully and honestly to patients that the things we have available to us are changing quickly. And I can say, yeah, this thing that I'm giving you, we didn't have that when I was in fellowship, or we didn't have that 2 years ago. And so even if we can't make your cancer go entirely away, if we can manage it in a way that you can get treatment and feel good or good enough while you're being treated, then who knows what we're going to have in 2 years. And yeah. I think that that's really genuine, that hope.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I think it's kind of that transition to, like, some of these things are turning into the ability to create a chronic disease management, like high blood pressure or diabetes. Obviously with cancer, it's very concerning and things can potentially change more quickly. But the longer we can do the management over time with the least side effects and the highest quality of life is going to continue to hopefully get longer and longer as the future here declares itself. So that's actually a great segue, because as far as, like, breakthroughs, what do you just think, like, gut feeling or in a lot of what the work you do each and every day, like, the next 5 to 10 years in cervical cancer management, like, what does that hold? Or what are some of the things that are, like, ready to break through and impact patients and providers?
I'm really hopeful that we are going to see more antibody drug conjugates and things in that sort of tisotumab family, more of the personalized medicine. I am hopeful that even in, I guess I'm ever hopeful that we will be able to increase HPV vaccine uptake, and that we can continue to try to see a decrease in the actual rates that these cancers develop. And I would say that the surgical approaches, you know, becoming less radical is important, but I would also like to see and hope to see some advances in the management of the more advanced, the locally advanced cervical cancers. And obviously that's when we work with, you know, folks like you so closely, is in trying to deliver radiation sort of as precisely as it can be done with the combination of external beam and then very sophisticated brachytherapy, so that even if we can't operate on something, that we still have curative intent with less collateral damage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's very exciting. So one other thing that's kind of been new for January of 2026 is that the FDA has recently approved an at-home test for cervical cancer. What are your thoughts on that? And how do you see that as kind of fitting into what everyone's doing at their medical clinics with their primary docs, their family physicians, their gynecologists, and how the at-home test kind of adds substitutes or gets included into what we're used to doing at baseline?
Yeah, that's really a great question. And it is, like you said, it's very new. The at-home test is a swab that a person would sort of self-swab up into the vagina and try to collect cells from around the cervix to then be tested specifically for HPV. And so it's a portion of what's happening in the clinic setting. In the clinic setting, that HPV is getting tested for, but also cells directly from a visualized cervix are getting collected, put onto slides, and looked at by an expert cytopathologist. They do training in pathology and then additionally in cytopathology. So I think that it has a role in some regard, because it is going to be more comfortable for patients who maybe have a trauma history or a history of challenging exams and pain with exams. People who are in incredibly rural areas where maybe there aren't as many docs to be able to see. So in resource poor settings, it can be helpful. I think the important thing to remember about it is that not all of cervical cancers are caused by HPV. It's a very large portion, but it's not 100%. And so it's not going to catch the non-HPV associated cervical cancers. It also needs to be done correctly. So if it's a poor sample, then you may not reflect whether or not HPV is present or not. HPV can be present sort of transiently and sort of more active and less active. So these are our potential drawbacks from it. And there's other things happening in a, you know, a gynecology or family medicine office when someone's doing a pelvic exam. So as we talked about at the beginning, you're also having a bimanual exam that's feeling for abnormalities, like palpably of the cervix and then of the other pelvic organs, like the uterus and the ovaries. People are looking at the vulva because there can also be precancers and cancers of the vulva. So I think it has a role and a place, but I don't, as a GYN oncologist, I don't see it replacing the conventional co-testing of a traditional pap smear and HPV.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And not directly the same, but even like in colon and rectal cancer screening, right? You have the Cologuard, or you have other kind of more at-home testing kits where you're trying to gain access to some of the less invasive, or to your point, if it is more difficult for people to find medical care consistently, sometimes with a reasonable test, some testing is better than no testing. And I think it'll be interesting to follow how things evolve as the future comes. So no, that makes a ton of sense. Thanks. We kind of talked about treatment advances, past, present, future, kind of in your personalized approach, in that kind of holistic approach to each and every patient. How much do you get into diet, lifestyle, mental health kind of during and after treatment? And what are kind of some of the big takeaways that you always try to make sure patients are aware of, or lifestyle modifications that might significantly impact what that future holds?
Yeah, these are super important to us. Sometimes it's really challenging to keep good nutrition and well hydrated and exercise while on cancer therapy. So I find that patients can best manage very sort of concrete plans and expectations. So a balanced diet is really what's needed, but that is sort of too broad. So I tell people that protein is really essential, and the goal is for them to get about a gram per kilogram of weight. That way they have a target and they can think about, and usually we'll talk about it real granular, right, in the clinic visit. This is what you weigh today. This is how I would think about breakfast, lunch, dinner. These are some of the foods that are higher than you'd think they would be that you can sort of add in easily. So protein is one of the things we talk about, and supplements. Sometimes people are willing to drink like the shakes and drinks that have protein. Hydration is another big one, and that's really important. Most of our chemos in gyn cancers, at least, are cleared through the kidney. So it's really important for people to stay hydrated. So we talk about that very granular as well. When it comes to exercise and such, I talk a little more broadly about it because people come with all different sort of functionality coming in. But the more that people stay active, the better they do with their treatment. If they want to know really specifically what they can do, I do think that somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 miles of total walking a day, or that 10,000 step rule of thumb, is at least something that is easy for people to shoot for. Everybody's phone keeps track of their steps, even if they didn't realize it was doing it. And so a lot of it's just kind of knowing. People might think they're eating a balanced diet, but once they start actually looking at what's in the foods, they realize they are pretty behind on things like protein. The mental health piece of it is separate from what we were just talking about, but so very integral to this, because a lot of our experiences of living with cancer, treating cancer, and the side effects of the treatments are going to be very amplified by where our mood is. And so I am very willing to get people started into seeing one of our social workers or counselors, getting into therapy, even starting medication for anxiety and depression, because I think that it's essential to their cancer care. You know, if it starts to get complex and outside of the scope of what I do as an oncologist, then obviously we hand off to family medicine, internal medicine, psychiatry. But most of my colleagues are willing to start people's depression and anxiety management because it is so integrated.
I think as we kind of come to closing today, really, it's always neat or inspirational, like when patients, families, trainees or kind of people within oncology view these sorts of podcasts or webinars, where really kind of a key message from a provider, an expert like such as yourself, right, to kind of give that hope and give that perspective for what the future kind of would hold. So if you could give one key message to patients and families or the medical community as a whole, as far as management of cervical cancer and where we're at, where we're going to be, kind of what would you like to say in that type of moment?
I think a key message is that there is a tremendous amount of hope in the community and amongst GYN oncologists for this cancer to be better treated, better managed, and for patients who are living a long time after treatment of cervical cancer, because it can and is often curable in early stages, to have less long-term side effects from our chemos, our radiations, and our surgeries. So it's, I think that my message is one of hope, and that has to do specifically with once someone has a cancer. But I think I cannot like leave a podcast like this without saying that I treat a lot of cancers that we have no way to screen for, that we don't catch early and don't even really have a precancerous time point where we can intervene, that they just sort of come out of the blue and are advanced and hard to treat. And so I would say, I think it's really important for anyone listening to this who has a cervix to know that you should get pap smears, that you should get screened, that just because average risk people can be screened every 3 to 5 years doesn't mean that you don't need to go, but every 5 years, you need to talk to your doctor about this. And it doesn't even have to be an OBGYN, actually. A family medicine doctor or primary care, internal medicine, they are trained to do pelvic exams and pap smears. And so I don't feel like you have to go out of your way to find a special doctor to talk to you about this. You can go to the same person who's treating your diabetes and high blood pressure or prescribing your contraception and just say, hey, I want to make sure that I've done all the things that I need and can do to help prevent cervical cancer. You can get the HPV vaccine up to age 45 now, covered by conventional insurance. And so even if you think that you've missed the window to be screened, you can, or to be vaccinated, you can get it. And you can get it at any pharmacy. When I was vaccinated, I was older than the cutoff. And so I had to wait for them to extend it to 45. And then when they did, I went and got vaccinated like at a regular commercial pharmacy. You get it day one, and then at least 2 months later, and then at least 6 months after the first dose. It's a pretty easy one to do. And then obviously getting the pap smears, because this is kind of a uncomfortable subject for a lot of patients and a lot of families. But please know that we as healthcare providers are used to thinking about and talking about this stuff. And we really just want to help people prevent cancer and live as long and well as they can.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So thank you so, so much for joining us today. I think I learned a lot, and I know our listeners and viewers will learn a lot as well. I think super important every year to be highlighting Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, continue to spread awareness, continue to spread information from highly respected professionals like yourself. So thank you so much for taking the time.
I really appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode of the Rad Onc on the Run podcast. Don't forget to subscribe for future episodes, and we'll see you next time.